This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Alhamdulillah, wassalatu wassalamu ala rasulillah. We begin by praising Allah and asking Allah to send His peace and blessings upon the final Prophet, Muhammad ibn Abdullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam, and all those who follow his way with righteousness until the end of time. Today's session is something I'm really excited to teach. In fact, it's the whole reason why I set up the six-week program. Really, I just wanted to teach this lesson. But to teach this lesson without everything that came before it wouldn't make sense. Right? Okay. To teach this lesson without everything that came before it would be out of context, it wouldn't make sense. And as it is, people are taking clips from this out of context to make me look bad. So if there was no context, it would be even worse, right? So now we built up with the context. Just this week and next week's lectures are the most important ones. And honestly, I'm just going to give you some background information on this subject, right? Very honest story. About 10 years ago, I met one of the scholars from who graduated from Medina University. Now, this scholar, he graduated from Medina University around the same time when I finished my Alim course. And we're having a discussion, and I was wearing, back then I used to wear the kurta full time, right? And he asked me, why are you doing this in South Africa? I told him, because it's what we taught to wear. He said, but al-ada muhakkama. I asked him, what's that? You did the Alim course, you never learned al-ada muhakkama? I asked him, no, it's quite al-fiqhiyah, he said. I said, what's that? He said, you did the Alim course, you never heard about Qaid al-Fiqhiyah? He sent me a whole lot of books. He said, read these books. I read those books, and my mind was blown, because those are Hanafi books, Maliki books, Shafi books. They aren't like, some people think this is a, you know, to be frank, some people think it's a modernist thing, some people think it's a Salafi thing. No, this is from the Madhabs. Whatever I'm teaching is from the Madhabs, right? So I was blown by what he taught me, and I'll always appreciate that brother who shared with me those links and told me about the subject. Changed my life, and to such an extent that I actually teach the subject online at the Islamic Online University. It's literally one of my favorite subjects. I read so many books on the topic. I start teaching it online to people all around the world, but I wasn't teaching it to my own community here in Durban. And one of the reasons why I began to feel the need to teach it in Durban is over the past 5 years, I've seen too many people starting to drift away from Islam, especially amongst the youth, because they find Islam too difficult to practice, right? You know, let's be frank, the average youngster, if you're going to tell him to be a good Muslim, you need to wear kurta and topi, he's not going to listen, right? It's just too hard for you. I mean, the guy is a lawyer, an accountant, he's a doctor, and we expect him to dress in a foreign culture every day at work. This is making the religion unnecessarily difficult. So I began to see a need for it. It's no longer something I want to teach. It's now something that's necessary. Someone has to start the discussion. What's happening over the past 10 years, every time I want to bring up this topic, people say, no, it's too controversial. No, don't talk about it. No, it's not time yet. But here's the point. It'll never be time. Someone's got to get the ball rolling. Someone's got to get started. So this week, inshallah, we're going to look at one of the most important principles of fiqh in the Hanafi madhab, and actually technically in all the madhabs, and that is urf, local culture. So this is a very technical discussion, but you will see at the end of it how practical it really is. And really for me, when I studied this, it's when I realized what a miracle the Sharia is. That the Sharia is a miracle. This really makes it practical in every time and place. And this is when you realize that the Sharia has to be from Allah. No human being could have thought up this system. So, before we begin, very quick revision, right? 2 weeks ago, we covered the revealed sources of fiqh. Quickly, what are the two revealed sources of fiqh? Very easy. Quran and? No, hadith? Sunnah. Right? Why not hadith? Because we said, not every hadith is sunnah. Right? And the Maliki madhab has a different definition of sunnah. So the word sunnah is more correct in terms of talking about what's the principle of fiqh. Right? So Quran and sunnah. Then last week we discussed the secondary sources. What are those? In Arabic, Ijma and Qiyas, consensus of the scholars and logical deduction. This week and next week we will discuss what are called the disputed sources, meaning they are found in the Hanafi madhab but not in all madhabs, right? In fact, the second one which we're going to discuss next week, Imam Ash-Shafi seemed to have been against it, although later Shafi's say that he may have misunderstood it and he technically also accepted. Right, so these two sources are Urf and Istihsan. So this week, we'll discuss Urf. Next week, we'll discuss Istihsan. And just very briefly, Urf means culture. Istihsan means to make things right. It basically means to seek a better alternative. That's another way of translating it. And what these two principles do is, Urf means that culture plays a role in fiqh. And Istihsan means that sometimes a fiqh ruling is making things difficult for society, so the ulama need to go to a different opinion, even if it's not the opinion that seems strongest to them. Right, a very controversial thing, but it's something Imam Abu Hanifa himself did, and we will discuss that next week. This week our focus is on Urf, right, which is, it is a solution to many of our problems, to put it as simple as that. So what is Urf? Urf simply means the dominant culture of a society. This is the definition of Urf. The dominant culture of a society. So Imam Abu Hanifa and Imam Malik stated that the Urf of a society is a basis for judgment, right? That the Urf of the society is a basis for taking fiqh rulings. To such an extent that one of Imam Abu Hanifa's students, Imam Muhammad ibn Hassan al-Shaybani, rahimahullah, stated that what can be proven through Urf is like something that can be proven through Quran and Sunnah, through the text. Right? It's on that level in the Hanafi Madhab. That if something is part of the Urf, you have to follow it. Right? So what does this mean? In Qawaid al-Fiqhiyah, in fiqh maxims, this is called the fifth maxim of fiqh, al-Ada Muhakkama. Local culture is the deciding factor. Now here's the important point. You will find the word Urf used in Hanafi fiqh and in Maliki fiqh. So some people assume that this is not found in the Shafi and Hanbali madhabs. But the maxim al-Ada Muhakkama is agreed upon by all four madhabs. So technically, even though the Shafis and the Hanbalis don't use the word Urf, they have this concept as well. Right? They just call it Qiyas. They call it a part of Qiyas. So what does this mean? What do we mean by local culture is the deciding factor? Again, for those who are not sure what I mean here by maxim, there are five maxims of fiqh, five main principles upon which we make qiyas, right? And these five are agreed upon by all the madhabs. Number one is that intentions are what actions are judged by, right? Every madhab agrees, your actions are judged by the intentions. For example, if you give someone 5 rand, is that sadaqah, is that zakah, is that a gift, is that a bribe? It's all intention. Literally the only difference between any of those things is the intention. Right? So literally giving somebody money can be a bribe, a sin, a zakah, a compulsory act, sadaqah, a voluntary act. It's all just the intention. That's the only thing that differs between these things. Right? What your intention is when giving that money. So that's the first one. The second one is that conviction cannot be removed by doubt. And this simply means that things stay in a specific ruling until proven otherwise. For example, things are halal until proven haram. The third one from the maxims of fiqh is that difficulty causes the law to relax. Right? And we'll discuss this next week because that's part of istihsan. The fourth one is that harm must be eliminated. And again, we'll discuss that next week because that's part of istihsan. The fifth one is al-ada muhakkama. Local culture is the deciding factor. So this means all of the madhabs agree that this is one of the five main maxims upon which fiqh is based. A large portion of our fiqh is based on culture. Why and how and what does this mean? It means that the culture of the good people of a society is considered urf and can be used as a source for local laws. Now I mentioned good people. Because obviously the local culture is to fornicate and drink alcohol, we're not going to take it into consideration, right? We're talking about the culture of the good Muslims, not the culture of the fasiqs and you know, the people who are involved in major sins. That's not what we're talking about. So again, some people misunderstand. They say, you know, if you follow culture, that means you're going to do everything. No, it's defined. There are limits put in it by the ulama. One of those limits being, we look at the culture of the good people, not the culture of the sinners. Why? Why do we have this principle? right? And again, when I go into the example, you understand this principle better. Well, why do we have a principle of culture? I mean, you know, many people have this idea that the Sharia is black and white. It's all clear-cut rulings in the Quran and Hadith. And, you know, what's applicable in India should be applicable in South Africa, right? But Allah has revealed a flexible Sharia. Because this Sharia has meant to be practiced in every time and every place from the time of the Prophet ﷺ right until the end of the world. Whether that's in 500 years or 5,000 years or 10,000 years, the Sharia has to remain practical. And for the Sharia to be practical, it has to take into consideration the fact that things change. Things change. Even in the time of the Sahaba, things change. And they change their rulings accordingly. Now, many people don't realize that Islam is meant to be multicultural. It's meant to be multicultural, meaning when you look at the culture of Muslims of Malaysia, the culture of the Muslims of Turkey, the culture of the Muslims of Saudi Arabia, completely different. But all three are within the fold of authentic Islam. All three fall within the fold of what's acceptable. Right? Why? Because these are different cultures, different. The Sharia didn't come to force everyone to look the same, to dress the same, to be the same. It takes into consideration that the way people talk, the way they eat, the way they interact with each other, it changes from place to place. And so we have an entire principle of fiqh to make sure that people aren't forced to do things in a way that makes life difficult. Islam was not sent to unite the world upon a single culture. It was sent to be practical in every culture. This is something people don't understand. On one hand, we have some people who are trying to Arabicize the world in the name of Islam. Make everybody like the Arabs. On the other hand, we have our community, those who want to Indianize people in the name of Islam. Right? And so, what this is, it's taking foreign cultures, whether it's from Saudi Arabia or India, and it's forcing it upon communities where it's not compatible. And this is creating friction. It's creating unnecessary friction. Because Islam was never meant to be like this. When the Sahaba moved to different lands, they did not force the people of those lands to dress like Arabs or live like Arabs. They adapted to the culture of those lands. And so the expectation in our Sharia is that we must adapt to the culture of the land we move to. Meaning, if you tomorrow had to migrate to Malaysia or to Turkey or to Australia or to Canada, you do not expect everybody in that community to start adapting your culture. You assimilate into their culture. That's part of our Sharia. Obviously within boundaries. The boundaries being Quran and Sunnah, and we'll come to that in a later slide. So this is the definition, very technical definition, which is basically that the culture is used in law. How, why, and what's the proof for this? Number one, let's start with the proofs. And again, there's many evidences. We'll just give one Quran, one Hadith, one Athar. What's Athar or Athar? Any of that? The Athar is a statement of the Sahaba. Right? So we're going to go through one something that Allah said, something that the Prophet ﷺ said, and something that one of the Sahaba said. Right? I'm just limiting it to three for now, because again, we don't have time to go into. We can give 1 hour just all the evidences. But the strongest evidence is in the Quran. In Surah An-Nisa, the verse about the rights of the wife. What are the rights of the wife in Islam? It's all up to urf. That's what the Quran says. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Surah An-Nisa verse 19, وَعَاشِرُهُنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ. Treat your wives with ma'aruf. What is ma'aruf? Ma'aruf is a derivative from the word urf. The books of tafsir translated as whatever is considered good in your culture. Meaning, does Islam say a man should get his wife a car or not? Whatever is the urf. Does a man have to give his wife an allowance or not? Whatever is the urf. If he has to give an allowance, how much? Urf. Right? Does he have to get her a domestic worker? Urf. Right? All of these things are not mentioned. You know, it's like sometimes our people fight over, does a woman have to cook for her husband or not? And if you ask me, it's urf. What's the local culture? Right? Both ways it works according to culture. So this is the beauty of the Sharia. Allah did not say, these are the rights of the husband, these are the rights of the wife. He just said, ma'ruf. Every society decide for yourself. Whatever is good according to the society, that is the urf, that is what becomes the rights in the Sharia. Meaning, if you are living in a country or in a society or in a part of a society where it is expected that a man buys his wife a car and he gives her 5,000 rand a month allowance and he gets her a domestic worker. In the Hanafi madhab, it becomes wajib for him to do these things. Even though it's not mentioned in the Quran and Sunnah. Right? Because of this verse. So this verse is the strongest evidence for urf. The fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala left an entire criteria of rights up to urf. Linked to this is a hadith, which again explains the same thing. So one of the women from the Quraysh, when the Prophet ﷺ conquered Makkah, one of the women who converted came to him and complained. She said, "My husband is very stingy. He doesn't give me any money." So what did the Prophet ﷺ say? He said, "Take from his wealth bil ma'ruf. Take from his wealth whatever you need according to your oath." Meaning, you know in your culture, in your level of society, how much money you need for your for you and for your children. Take that from him without his permission because it's your right. He didn't give a specific amount. He left it for her to decide based on her oath. Right? Because obviously, a woman from a certain level of society is going to expect something. A woman from a different level of society is going to expect something else. Right? And so, meeting this woman for the first time, he left it up to urf. Number three, Athar from the Sahaba, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud radiallahu anhu said, "Whatever the Muslims deem to be good is good in the sight of Allah." Meaning you move to a Muslim country. Everybody, including the good Muslims, are doing something. And they consider it to be a good deed. Then inshallah, that's a good deed in the sight of Allah. Right? Inshallah. And again, there are restrictions on this. Now, some people mistake this as a hadith. It's not a hadith. It's a statement from Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. Nonetheless, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud was one of the first 10 people to convert to Islam and one of the ulama amongst the Sahaba. So when he talks, he's not just talking, you know, his own thing. He's teaching us the religion. So his statements count as evidence in the field of fiqh. And by the way, the Hanafi madhab goes back to this Sahabi. All the madhabs can be traced back to different Sahaba. Imam Abu Hanifa's teachers were the students of Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. So technically the Hanafi approach to fiqh goes back to Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. Right? But obviously Imam Abu Hanifa was the one who formulated the usul, and you know that's why it's named after him instead. So this is clear. The Quran is very clear and the hadith is very clear that certain things are left up to culture. They are not defined directly in the Quran and the hadith. But then comes the question. The question is, you know, can people abuse this? Anything can become halal based on urf. Right? We say no, there are conditions. There are conditions to accept something as the urf. Condition number one, it must be popularly and consistently followed by the majority of people. Meaning, someone comes up and he says that, you know, it's a part of our urf that the wife provides for the husband 10,000 rand every month. And you say, where did you get that urf from? He says, no, my cousin does that. Your cousin's practice is not urf. It must be popular and consistently done by the majority. Then we can think about it. Right? But if it's one person, 10 people, 20 people, that's not urf. Right? That's actually going against the urf. Number two, it must be current. Current, meaning at the time of making the rulings. So if someone says that they use a word, and that word is considered vulgar in our culture. And he said, oh, I didn't mean that. I meant this. And he used a meaning that word meant 500 years ago. Right? We say, no. What you say is judged by what it means today, not what it meant 500 years ago. Because we know languages change, right? Certain words which are considered fine today were considered vulgar 50 years ago. Certain words that are considered vulgar today will be fine 50 years from now. So as the culture changes, the ruling changes. So for example, the fiqh of what type of words are not appropriate for a Muslim to use, vulgar language. Again, you're not going to find a list of vulgar words in the Quran and Hadith. It's left up to urf, right? Whatever your culture considers to be vulgar language, avoid it. And that will change. So it's obvious based on what's the current, what's the current attitude towards that word. Right? That's what you have to look at. Number three. An urf cannot contradict a stipulated condition. Right? An example of this. If a man bought furniture and he signed in a condition in the contract that he will organize his own transport for that furniture. And later on the seller says, but part of our urf, you know, or rather later on he tells the seller, part of our urf is that the seller provides the transportation. In that case, even if that's part of the urf, it still won't count. Why? They signed the contract. It's the same with the husband and wife, right? If the husband and wife, for example, sign a contract saying that he can't take a second wife. And he says, but it's part of my oath that we take a second wife. You sign the contract, too late. Right? Oath cannot contradict a signed contract. If once something is stipulated, you cannot go against it, even if it's part of your oath. Right? Number four, most important, and this is the main one. Urf cannot go against the Quran, Sunnah, or Ijma. Right? So, for example, some people will say, part of our urf is that women don't cover their hair. And we will say, that doesn't matter. The Quran is clear, the Hadith is clear, there's Ijma on this issue. It doesn't matter what the urf is here. Right? Because you cannot go against the Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma based on urf. And finally, we have the one area of controversy between the madhabs. When the urf contradicts qiyas, what do we do? So most of the madhabs will say you'll follow qiyas. The Hanafi madhab says, no, the Hanafi madhab has another principle called istihsan bil urf, which we will discuss next week, which basically means you're going to have to weigh the benefits and harms and see what is more beneficial to society, which oftentimes in the Hanafi madhab means following the local culture. So these are the conditions. So you can see, once you put these conditions in place, this principle can't be abused. Right? It's not where anything and everything becomes halal on it, because there are conditions made by the ulama. Okay, moving on to that. So how do we use urf in fiqh? So you may be wondering, we're talking about culture, we're talking about abstract, let's get practical now. How does culture play a role in fiqh? Because isn't fiqh just what's stated in the books, isn't it just these fatwas, isn't it just a list of rulings in the hadith? No. Right? A lot of fiqh comes from culture. Firstly, the main principle. We use urf primarily in the mu'amalat, not in the ibadat. Fiqh is divided into two broad categories. Ibadat, mu'amalat. Ibadat, easy word. What does that mean? Acts of worship. Salah, zakah, fasting, jihad, hajj, umrah. These are ibadat. These things, urf rarely plays a role. It does play a role, but a very minor role. Right? The other side, mu'amalat. Mu'amalat means social dealings. Marriage, divorce, the fiqh of clothing, the fiqh of food, the fiqh of business. All of this is mu'amalat. So we use urf mainly in mu'amalat. A lot of our fiqh in these areas comes from whatever is the local culture. That's where the fiqh comes from. You're not going to find it in the Quran or Hadith. Allah left it to people to decide. And to left it to change from place to place and time to time. This is how Allah left it. To make the Sharia practical. He gave us guidelines. He gave us the Quran. He gave us Sunnah. He gave us Ulama. He gave us these conditions. All of this He gave us. But He left it so that the Sharia doesn't become too hard. Right? It's something which can be practiced everywhere. So how have the Ulama in the past used Urf in Fiqh? For example, business law. Business law is largely dependent on Urf. For example, who provides transportation? The buyer or the seller? It's urf. Right? What counts as a business deal? Because technically, if you're going to follow the hadith, then when we're selling something, for example, if you are in a shop and you are buying a hard drive, you have to walk up to the person and say, I am buying this hard drive from you. And the person has to say, I am selling this hard drive to you, or I accept. Does anybody do this today? No, people think you're mad. Right? Why? The urf has changed. So what's accepted as a business deal, this is based on urf. In some communities, it's verbal. In some communities, it's a written contract. In some, it's a handshake. Nowadays, you just put something on the counter and the person knows you're buying it from him. Right? You don't have to say anything. So this is all dependent on urf. How do we define what's considered a business deal? It's largely based on urf. Very important. The age of marriage. At what age do we expect our children to get married? Right? Because we know that the Sahaba got married when they were 9 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old. Does anyone expect this of the children today? No. Why? It's urf. Cultures change. Our culture is different. This is not how we do things in our time. You know, like recently there was always controversy about the age of Aisha, radiallahu anha. And you know, one of the points that the atheists raised about it, they said that your prophet is supposed to be someone you follow in every time and place. So how can he get married in a way that you don't do today? We say he got married according to the urf of his time. He's simply teaching us to get married according to the urf of our time. In his time, that was normal. In our time, this is normal. So we are following his sunnah. And there's no contradiction here. That in that time, that was the norm. It was a complete norm in every society for an older man to marry a young girl. That norm has changed. Right? So we don't do it. We don't think about it. It doesn't even cross our minds. Right? So in every community, the age of marriage depends on... Oh, so in some communities, it's 15. In some, it's 18. In some, it's 20. In some, it's 25. It's all based on urf. This doesn't mean it's haram before that. It's just you're not expected before that. And in many cases, it becomes makruh before that. Even makruh tahrimi, depending on people's, you know, maturity levels. The rights of spouses, we already discussed this. The Quran is very clear. Right? The Quran is very clear that the rights of spouses is fundamentally based on ma'aruf, whatever the urf considers to be good. Which means that the rights of spouses changes from culture to culture. In some cultures, the wife's expected to cook. In some cultures, the husband's expected to provide food. In some cultures, they're expected to hire a cook. In some cultures, they eat out every day. Right? Cultures change. So, there's no set ruling here. You just look at what's your urf. Manners. You know, there's an example of current urf versus previous urf. 20 years ago, it would be considered bad manners for a child to say, yes, mom, to his mother. You have to say, ji, mama. In the current generation, if a child says, yes, mom, it's considered good manners. Right? Instead of calling her by her name. Right? Because cultures change. So, how do you know what's good manners for you or for your children? Whatever is the current urf. Manners change based on urf. In some societies, for example, you know, people shake hands with the sheikh. In some, they kiss his hand. In some, they kiss his forehead. All of this is just different urfs. Whatever good manners is, whichever country you are visiting, you treat people accordingly. Right? So, manners, a large segment of it is based on culture. Entertainment. What is socially acceptable is also determined by urf. So, in every society, there are some entertainments that are considered shady, or something that the bad people only do, and the other forms of entertainment that everybody does. Right? And this changes with urf. So for example, again, maybe 20, 30 years ago, if someone's playing with the cards, you know, people would say, you know, it's haram, what you're doing, this is resembling gambling. Today nobody bats an eyelid about it as long as there's no gambling involved. Why? The urf has changed. Right? So again, certain things are socially acceptable 20 years ago and not today, other things the opposite. So, urfs change when it comes to entertainment as well. Historically, we can say that the Prophet ﷺ and the Sahaba, the way they dressed, the way they ate, the way they lived their social lives, was largely according to the urf of Arabia. And very important point, we are not obligated to follow the urf of Arabia from 1400 years ago. So, for example, there are those who say, it's haram to sit on a table and chair, you must sit on the floor. Because that's what the Prophet did. Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. We say no, that was his urf. Right? Our urf is different. You say you have to dress the way the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam did. We say no, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam did not wear a dafa kurta. He did not wear Indian topi. He dressed in whatever the Arabs were 1400 years ago. Right? So he dressed according to his urf. We dress according to our urf. This is the actual fiqh rulings found in early Islam. There is no expectation in early Islam for Muslims to have a uniform dress code. It's just every culture is different. And that's what is left up to. And we know this from the Sahaba. Why? Because when the Sahaba moved to other lands, they changed. Umar radiallahu anhu, when he went to visit the Sahaba in Syria, what did he say about them? He said, everybody's changed. The way they dress, to the way they live, to everything. He said he couldn't recognize some of them. You know, Khalid bin Walid and Amr bin al-As, he couldn't recognize them because the way they dressed was different, the way they lived was different, everything was different. Why? They did not take Medina's culture and force it on Syria. They adapted to the culture of Syria. The very beautiful story about this, when Muawiyah radiallahu anhu was the governor of Syria, Umar radiallahu anhu, you know, he asked him, he said, you are living like a king. You are dressing like a king. You've got this, you know, this fancy lifestyle. I'm the Khalifa, I'm living this simple lifestyle. What's going on here? And Muawiyah simply explained, radiallahu anhu, he explained that the people of Syria, this used to be part of the Roman Empire. They expect their leader to dress like this and live like this. When their leader dresses like this and lives like this, they are loyal to him. And they love him. So Umar left it. He didn't say anything. He left it. And that's why for the next 40 years, the people of Syria were loyal to Muawiyah. Because he didn't come and force the Arab culture upon them. He came and he fitted right in with their culture. He said, okay, these guys are used to the Roman lifestyle, we will adapt to the Roman lifestyle. Right? Today, many of us will call that resembling the kuffar. Right? But no, it's not. You adapt to the urf that you live in. And the Sahaba did this in Egypt, they did this in Syria, they did this in Iraq. Every land they moved to, they adapted to the culture of that land. Syria is the clearest example because we have many stories of it. Another example of urf, you'll notice that throughout our history, the way people celebrated marriages differed. Right? So, for example, if you look at the wedding culture of Malaysia, or Egypt, or Turkey, even today, it's all different. Even our culture. So, for example, if someone had to tell you, where does it come in the Quran and Sunnah that we have a wedding? What will be your answer? There's no such thing. There's nikah and walima. So, is a wedding bid'ah? Is a wedding haram? It's urf. It's urf. What about the mehndi party? It's also urf. Right? You go to another culture, they have something completely different. Right? Now, how do you know if it's halal or haram? Again, the principles you mentioned earlier. Right? So, bachelor parties and things like that, again, you know, you're going to weigh it in light of Quran and Sunnah and, you know, all of that. You're not going to just say, oh, it's my urf, so I'm going to do it. Right? There is that level. And one of the clearest examples in our history and right till today of urf in practice is how hijab is worn by women. So the Sharia stipulates that a woman must cover everything besides her hands and her face. Right? And the Hanafi madhab, her feet as well, is also allowed to expose. Notice the way this is done is different in Turkey, it's different in Malaysia, it's different in Saudi Arabia, it's different in North Africa, it's different in different parts of India. Why? Why? Urf. It's culture. Every culture has its own way. As long as it fulfills the conditions, it's fine. Right? So again, some people have a misconception. They say, no, it has to be a black abaya, it has to be a black scarf, because that's how they do it in Saudi Arabia. That's not it. That's their urf. Our urf is different. You don't have to follow their urf. That's not this country. And when you go to visit there, you should follow their urf. That's the important point. When you're visiting another country, respect the urf of that country. So for example, when I visit certain countries, I wear the kurta or the sob or whatever it is their culture. Right? Because you must adapt to the culture you are in. You don't be the odd one out. Right? So again, it's also important that we don't look down upon other urfs and other cultures. This is very important because I've seen this on both sides. I've seen Muslims in the East look down upon Western culture, and Muslims in the West look down upon Indian culture and Muslim culture and Arab culture, etc. Both of these attitudes are wrong. We must respect all cultures. This is part of our religion. Respect all cultures. One culture is not better than another. Right? We don't have to have this thing of cultural being superior in our culture. Every culture has beauty in it. Really, if you take time to meet people of any part of the world, you will find every culture has beauty in it. So learn to respect every culture. Don't look down upon a culture because it's different from your own. Okay, very briefly, I have to mention this point that nowadays people don't want us to talk about urf because there is a portion of the community that misuse this principle, and that is the modernists, right? So basically, the modernists, they use urf to override Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma. That's basically it. They say, you know, if it's our culture, we follow it. Even though it goes against the Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma, the clearest example of this is hijab. Right? So you will find in South Africa, in America, in some of these countries, certain people saying that women don't need to cover their hair because it's not part of our urf. This does not fall within the framework of acceptable differences of opinion. Right? Because it's contradicting the Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma. This is what we call modernist reinterpretation. This is what people are afraid of. People are afraid of that if we go with these principles, this is what we're going to do. And we say no. We go with these principles within the boundaries set by the early ulama. We're not going to go overboard and just make everything halal. There are boundaries set. We have the Quran, we have the Sunnah, we have the Ijma. We respect it and we work within it. So, the important point to remember here, so you don't fall into modernism in your fiqh, is that urf is a secondary principle of fiqh, and it cannot override the primary sources of fiqh. Right? You cannot override Quran with urf. You cannot override sunnah, proven sunnah with urf. And again, I say proven sunnah. I'm not talking about where people have difference of opinion, is that sunnah or not. Right? So, we must use this within its limits. So I just wanted to mention that very briefly. Everyone clear on that point, by the way. I don't want anyone coming out from here, thinking that I'm turning everyone into modernists. Okay, now comes the main part of the presentation. The reason why I wanted to teach this entire course, and the reason why I wanted to teach this topic in specific, is that we South Africans have not applied the principle of urf to our fiqh. When we brought fiqh to South Africa, we brought a book of fatwas from India that was written 300 years ago. And by the way, every single fatwa there makes sense. It makes sense in India 300 years ago. Why? Because it was written according to the urf of their times. For example, you will find fatwas in this book stating that it's haram to go to school. Sounds strange, right? What was happening 200, 300 years ago? The British were colonizing India, opening up schools to brainwash people. So the ulama of that time said it's haram to go to school. So if you were living in India 200 years ago, that fatwa makes sense. You can't take that fatwa and pass it on 200 years later. The world has changed. Right? You cannot just take a fatwa from a book 200 years ago in a different country, in a different social setting, and just pass it along today saying that this is the Sharia, this is the Hanafi Madhab. It's not. It is the scholars of that time, by the way. And the scholars of that era, you know, when the British were colonizing India, the scholars who were refuting them and dealing with them were very intellectual. And the fatwas they made were based on the problems of their time and place. So the problem isn't them, the problem isn't their fatwas. Right? You will find that fatwas make sense when you understand where they were living and when they were living. The problem is when you try to blindly follow that in the wrong time and place. That's the problem. Right? So we have to now, as a community, reconsider many fiqh issues based on the fact that we are South Africans more than Indians. Right? I'm saying it primarily because most of the audience here are from that Indian background, right? Most majority of the audience here. And obviously, if you came from other backgrounds, you're also South African more than anything else. Now, there's multiple problems here. Number one, South Africa doesn't have one culture. Right? So, for example, it's easy to figure out the fiqh of Malaysia or Turkey because these are primarily one culture across the entire country. South Africa, we have a different culture in Cape Town, a different culture in Johannesburg, a different culture in Durban. In Durban, we have a different culture amongst one race, a different culture amongst another race. Even within one race, the Indians, we have a different culture amongst Indians in Amshlanga and Indians in Chatswood. Right? So how do we figure out our fiqh? How do we figure it out? It really has to be case by case. That's what it comes down to. It has to be case by case. We have to keep fiqh flexible enough to say, okay, who am I talking to? Where is he from? What's the culture of his community? We now have to deal with subcultures. We have to say, okay, you are from Amshlanga, right? And you're getting married to a girl from Amshlanga. You have to get her a maid. You have to get her a car. You have to give her a certain amount of money every month because that's her urf. That's what she expects. You from a different part of the country where you don't expect that, the urf changes. So in the olden days, we would say that urf changed from country to country. But because now in South Africa we are a multicultural society, you can say urf changes literally from one neighborhood to another. Right? Because our cultures are so diverse. But we have to bring up these topics. Now what I'm going to do is, I'm not going to give fatwas. And I'm not here to pass fatwas. I'm simply saying, whatever I mention now, we need to discuss it. We need to discuss it in light of urf. If after the discussion we go back to the conclusion that it's haram or whatever, fine. As long as we had the discussion and we approach it from the right angle. But if there are some of these issues, we can say, hold on, we got this wrong. It's actually makruh tahrimi, it's actually makruh tanzih, it's actually halal. You know, then we can inshallah make fiqh a bit easier for our people while still staying within the framework of Hanafi fiqh. Right? So number one is our dress code. Number one, the idea, you know, it's strange. 20 years ago, people were saying it's sunnah to wear kurta and topi. Now I see big posters in some masjid saying it's wajib to wear kurta and topi. Where did the wajib come from? You know, so this has to be reconsidered. This seriously has to be reconsidered. Where are we getting this from? It's not in the Quran. It's not in the hadith. There's no consensus on it. It really goes against qiyas. It goes against urf. It goes against istihsan. Where does this fatwa come from? Right? So we have to reconsider. And again, this means ulama need to sit together and say, really, is this wajib? Is this sunnah? And what does the actual teachings of our madhab say? And we have to come to a more practical conclusion. Because we are unnecessarily making life difficult for our people. Number two, the fiqh of entertainment. Right? So is it haram for a husband and wife to sit and watch Netflix together? Some of you say they're watching Eight Rules, so it's fine. Right? Some of you say no, Eight Rules haram. It's movies. Right? How do we decide? How do we decide what's halal, what's haram in terms of entertainment? Where do we go from here? A large portion of it is based on Quran and Sunnah. A large portion of it is based on Qiyas. But similarly, a large portion of it is based on Urf. Right? So for example, is it socially acceptable for a practicing Muslim man or woman to go to the cinema? That really depends on your Urf. In Saudi Arabia, no. In Malaysia, yes. Why? Their Urfs are different. Their cultures are different. In one culture is socially acceptable, in the other culture it's not. Right? So we have to figure out what's socially acceptable in our culture when it comes to entertainment. Nothing. All entertainment is haram. Right? Well, that's literally chasing our youth away from Islam. You want to know why the youth are not coming for lectures like this? Why they don't want anything to do with Islamic knowledge? Because that's what they taught in school. That's what they taught from the time they're small. It's all haram. You know, TV is haram, video games haram, music's haram, everything's haram. Right? What's the alternative? Alternative, you do it anyway, we're doing haram anyway. Eventually the guilt catches up with him, like, you know what? Might as well just not be a Muslim anymore. I've met many people like this. Who like, these people say, you know what, when I'm a Muslim, I'm not taking the religion seriously. These rules are too hard to follow, so I'd rather not be a Muslim anymore. Now I'm not saying that whole apostasy issue can be solved by this. I'm saying a small segment of it can. A small segment of it can. That we need to at least give people practical fiqh. Give them practical solutions. So for example, playing video games, right? You know, if you're going to say haram to play video games, you know, what are you telling our entire three generations of Muslims now? Everything you do for fun is haram. I mean, why do we set boundaries? Okay, this type of video game is fine, this type is not. 2 hours is fine, 5 hours is not. You know, you have to figure things out. Again, I'm not giving a fatwa. I'm saying we have to discuss. We have to figure things out. We have to set boundaries. We have to figure out what's socially acceptable based on our oath. Celebrations and special occasions. Is it really haram to celebrate a birthday? For a husband and wife to go out on the anniversary and have a special dinner? To buy your mother something nice for Mother's Day? Is it? I'm not saying it is, I'm not saying it's not. I'm simply saying, let's discuss it. Let's discuss it based on these principles. And then decide. Don't just jump to the idea of it being haram. Because what did we say? Things are halal until proven to be haram. So if we can, discuss it and say, okay, you know, birthdays are acceptable if you do this and you don't do that. Okay, that's fine. But if after all discussion we still say, okay, it's haram, that's also fine. Both opinions are grounded in usul al-fiqh. It's not a matter of one opinion being deviant and one opinion not. These are all qiyas issues and there will be differences of opinion. I'm simply saying we need to reopen the doors of discussion on these issues. Marital norms and responsibilities. This is, you know, a big one. A lot of our fatawa are imported from India on this issue. And a lot of it is not practical in South Africa. Right? Because our social norms have changed and the expectations of the husband and wife have changed. So when you have someone who's just following the fatwa, so the fatwa says I must get my wife clothes, house, food. Okay, check, everything is done. I'm going to go play video games for the rest of the evening. Right? You get guys with this mentality now. They say, you know, this is all the fatwa book says. The book simply says I must provide her with a house, I must provide her with clothing, I must provide her with food. Is that really all you have to provide her with? You know, I mean, what about our culture is a culture of spending quality time with your spouse. Should we have a fatwa about that? Not every culture has that, by the way. In some cultures, you don't have that. Some cultures, the women are in their own world, the men are in their own world, and they just meet up for an hour in the evenings. But our culture is different, so we really have to reform our fiqh to figure out, you know, what is culturally acceptable when it comes to, and what is the expectations, what is wajib upon the husband and wife in terms of how much time they spend with each other, what they do together, you know, what's expected from them in terms of money, in terms of all of these things. Business law. A lot of it, I said, is dependent on Urf. So again, we cannot just import fatwa on business law. It has to come from the ground up. It has to be people living in this community. Let me give you a good example of this, right? What's coming up on Friday? Black Friday. So, every year on Black Friday, I put up an advertising my Black Friday sales. And I have thousands of people telling me, Black Friday is haram. Black Friday is bid'ah. Black Friday is an insult to the day of Jummah. Jummah is not black, it's white. I say that's racist. But anyway, what's wrong with the word black? I mean, come on. So, what's going on here? Why are some people jumping? You notice the people who jump on this issue, and I noticed it online, are people who live in a culture where, guess what? They don't have Black Friday. They don't have it, it's not part of their culture. So when they hear this word, they immediately assume bid'ah, haram, innovation, something new. Meanwhile, for us living in South Africa, it's like, it's normal, it's something we look forward to every year, right? So, is it haram to have special deals on a Black Friday? Is it haram to buy the deals on a Black Friday? No. Right? No. Local ulama will look at it from this perspective. Is this part of our culture? Is there a religious basis for it or not? Is it harmful to society? And they'll look at all these things and then they will say, no, but ... they may add some conditions, right? Don't be extravagant, don't be materialistic, don't waste money on things you're not going to use. They'll add some conditions. But the point is, this is a clear example where the business law is a clash of cultures. Right? So when I send out my email, it's going to people in Egypt, it's going to people in India, it's going to people in America. People in America buy it, people in India and Egypt are calling me a bidati. Right? And every year, at this time of day, I ask myself, should I send out the email or not? Right? Should I send out the email or not? Because I know I'm going to get customers, but also know I'm going to get 1,000 people calling me a bidati for sending out this email. So clash of cultures is a big issue when it comes to business law. Right? Finally, the issue, tashabbu bil kuffar, imitating the disbelievers. Honestly, I think this is an issue where we're the only community that went overboard in this. I mean, we even have some fatawa like it's haram to use fork and knife because it's a Christian culture. Right? Or haram to sit on a chair because it's not our culture. Or it's haram to wear a tie. I don't know, does anyone still say that?
Yes.
They still say that? Oh, okay, I thought that died out 10 years ago. Okay. So, haram to wear a tie because it's what they say it resembles the cross or something like that. Again.
No, we got kids. We've been dealing with issues. The kids, Swarana, have gone to school. The kids are in front of the principals. Now,
so, it's a big issue now.
Yeah.
So, we have to reconsider these issues. We have to rediscuss these issues. Honestly, one of my life goals is to come up with a new fiqh for our community based on these principles and to write an entire book on this topic that will be like how Dr. Yusuf Qaradawi's book is for Egypt, you know, Halal Haram in Islam, something similar for South Africa. You know, alhamdulillah, I'm an author, so inshallah one day I'll do that. But we have to have the discussion because the hadith, man tashabbaha biqawmin fahuwa minhum, whoever resembles a people is one of them. I believe this is one of the most misunderstood hadiths in our community. Because technically, almost any other country I visited, any ulama I spoke to from across the globe, even Hanafi ulama in other countries, they all understand that hadith to mean imitating the religious practices of another religion, not imitating the normal culture. Right? I met a few who said, but most of them said, it's talking about religious practices. So for example, wearing a cross, wearing that the Hindu dot on your head, this would be haram because you are identifying with another religion. This makes sense, right? It doesn't mean everything the non-Muslims do is automatically haram. And we see this in the life of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The evidences for this are clear. Once someone gave the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam as a gift a red Roman shawl, right? This part of the Roman culture, they wore these red shawls. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam accepted the gift and he wore it. He didn't say this is kafir culture, Christian culture, Roman culture. He accepted it and wore it. Another issue, more sensitive issue, on the issue of intimacy with one's wife while she's the 2-year breastfeeding period. So the Prophet said, I wanted to make this haram. Listen to his points. He said, I wanted to make this haram. But I noticed that the Christians, rather the Romans and the Persians, they do this and it doesn't harm their children. So I left it haram. So what did he look at to leave something halal? He looked at what the non-Muslims were doing. He looked at the Christians and the Zoroastrians. He saw they were doing this. It wasn't harming their children. So he left it as halal. And here he literally not only followed what the non-Muslims were doing, he literally looked at them to study their civilization and see what was the effects of it. Right? Meaning he did not outright say whatever the non-Muslims do is haram. Because he dressed the same way Abu Jahl and them dressed. He ate the same way they ate. He sat and slept the same way they did in terms of the culture. It wasn't a matter of distinguishing oneself from non-Muslims. It's a matter of distinguishing oneself from their religion. Right? So a lot of our fatwas are based on a misunderstanding of this hadith. When you wear a shirt and pants, you say you are resembling the kafir. Right? When you eat with a fork and knife, you are resembling the kafir. Once I remember, I was on Hajj and I asked one of the Mulanas if he prayed yet. He's like, you don't use that word pray, you say namaz. Why? He said, pray is a Christian word. No, it's not. It's just the English translation. That's all. Right? So, this is the issue. This is a big issue. I mean, do you realize how many things we have declared haram which are not haram simply because of this one last point, imitating the disbelievers? There are literally so many, and we're not applying it consistently, by the way. Because who invented Facebook and our cars and our phones, everything? It's also, I mean, this culture we have of checking social media whole day, where did this culture come from? It's not from the Muslims. So why? How do you decide what part of their culture is acceptable and what is not? We say, is it part of their religion or not? Right? And you take that back also to celebrations. So definitely, a celebration that's part of a non-Muslim religion, like celebrating Christmas, right? We would say it's haram because it's part of their religion. But something which has no religious significance whatsoever, something like an anniversary. A man and a woman have been married for 25 or 30 years. Nowadays, it's just like a miracle, you know, because of the amount of divorces we have. Celebrate it, you know, it's like, I understand why people want to celebrate it. You know, it's like, wow, they actually made it, they're actually still together. Right? So, I understand, are they doing anything haram? I mean, how many things are actually haram between husband and wife? Very few, right?
What about the Senna certified this day?
Yeah. Again, it's an inconsistency. It's a big inconsistency there. Is this resembling the carpet or not? I mean, I love the Easter egg, they're delicious, but I have the dilemma myself. Am I resembling disbelievers waiting for this to come out every January to April and eat it? Or we have to have discussions on it. We have to really go deep and figure out, does this fall under imitating the disbelievers or not? Okay, so let's summarize and then we'll open the floor to Q&A for the last half an hour. In summary, Urf plays an important role in Hanafi fiqh. Technically, it plays a role in every madhab. But in the Hanafi madhab, it's given a higher status. Right? It plays a bigger role in Hanafi fiqh than any other madhab. Right? And what it means is, the local culture takes precedence over foreign cultures. Which meant, when we migrated to South Africa 100 years ago, we were supposed to assimilate into this culture, not bring our culture with us. Right? When we opened up madrasas in this country, they should have been based on the local culture, not importing a foreign culture. That was our first mistake. We brought that culture with us, thinking it to be the religion, and as a result, we've chased entire generations away from Islam. Really, we have. We've chased entire generations away from Islam. You know, a few years ago, I made the decision to start wearing shirt and pants full time. It wasn't easy because in this community, if you're an Islamic teacher and you don't wear a kurta, I was told nobody will take you seriously. Like, that's what we told. If you don't wear a kurta, people won't take you seriously. Looking at the sheer number of people in the room today, I don't think that's an issue anymore. Right? Alhamdulillah. But it was a big decision at that time, and I wondered to myself, should I or shouldn't I? And one thing made me do it. I went to give a lecture that week. The first time I was wearing shirt and pants, I was very nervous. I went to give a lecture to children. It was a group of like 50 children. And I spoke to them about Islam. And after, one of the boys came up to me and he said that he wanted to study Islam, but he was afraid if he studies Islam and becomes a Mawlana, he'll have to wear kurta and topi full time. But because he sees I'm a student of Islam, I'm wearing shirt and pants, he's now motivated to go and study Islam. So I said, okay, that's enough reason for me to wear shirt and pants. If even one or two kids, Iman is saved and they push to become scholars of Islam or something because there's one person in the community doing things differently, I'm going to do it. But it really showed me the importance of the youth being able to see this. That there are alternatives. It's not black and white, that this is the only understanding. And by the way, I'm not even saying this understanding is completely wrong. It's ijtihadi. I'm simply saying is we need to reconsider it. I mean, someone who says celebrating the anniversary of a husband and wife being haram, I understand it. From a qiyas perspective, from an ijtihad perspective, I can understand how you come to that conclusion. Right? So I respect that opinion. I'm simply saying, there is another opinion. Let's discuss both opinions and see which one makes more sense. And it's very important that on these issues we respect the different opinions. Because I remember back when I used to believe that birthdays were haram, a lot of people mocked me for that. And then when I started believing it's not haram, a lot of people mocked me for that. I mean, what's up? Why can't we just respect the difference of opinion, whichever side you want? Now, why do you have to mock the other side and make it sound like they, you know, outside the fold of Islam on these issues? It's not. It's ijtihadi. These are purely ijtihadi issues. They didn't exist in the first few generations. So we have to figure it out ourselves. So remember, when moving to a new culture, adapt to the local culture. Don't try and force your culture upon them. It's very important. If you move to another country, even if it's temporarily, assimilate. As far as it's halal, obviously, right? Don't assimilate into the haram aspects. So when you move anywhere in the world, you assimilate into their culture, the halal aspects of it. Our mistake in South Africa is we did not do that. Very important, laws are based on urf when it does not contradict the Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma. So things can become wajib because of an urf. Right? Things can become wajib because of urf. Example in business law. If it is the urf that the seller provides transportation, for example, a furniture shop, it is wajib upon the sellers, the furniture shops in that community to provide transportation. Why? Because that's what the customer expects. Right? So literally something can become wajib based on an urf. And this happens in marriage as well. And my main point, the whole reason why we had the 6-week program, or why we have next week's final discussion as well, is we have to as a community reevaluate our fiqh in light of urf. We have to do it. We are losing entire generations because we are not doing it. We have losing so many people because we are just taking fatwas that we don't understand, that are based on a different time and a different place, and forcing them on our people. And by the way, I wanted to mention an example earlier, I forgot, so let me mention it at this point, right? Let me give you an example of how urf changes and how fatwas change. About 50 years ago, there's fatwas from very reliable senior ulama saying it's haram for a woman to wear pants. Right? Now, if you understand the urf of that time, the fatwa makes sense. Can we now just take the fatwa and follow it today? Our urf has changed. Now we have specifically something called woman's pants. That if a man wears that, that's haram. Because he's resembling a woman. So our urfs have changed, right? For 50, 60 years ago, all women wore long skirts. That was their culture. Pants was a men's thing. So wearing a pants was considered resembling men, which is haram. The urf has changed. We now have men's pants and women's pants. Right? And a man wearing a woman's pants would be resembling a woman. Right? So that fiqh has to change. You can't just take... Now this is something that's just 50 years ago. And already we're saying, this fatwa passed 50 years ago, we can't apply it today. What about the fatwa passed 200 or 300 years ago? Right? So it's very important that we re-evaluate things. Urf is one of the necessary principles for reforming fiqh for every time and place. This is how the Sharia stays flexible and practical. This is how Islam stays relevant to every society. This is why Islam cannot become outdated. Unlike man-made laws, Islam cannot become outdated simply because it is adaptable to every time, place, and culture. And certain aspects of it change from time, place, and culture. Right? So, we see very practical examples. In the time of the Prophet ﷺ, girls would get married when they're 9 years old. Nobody does that today because it's not our urf. In the time of the Prophet ﷺ, Muslims owned slaves. Nobody does that today besides Mauritania, right? Yeah, Mauritania. And a few other countries. But in our urf, South Africa, nobody does that. No one thinks about doing that. Nobody hopes to revive the sunnah of doing that. Why? It's not our culture. It's not the world we live in. It's not something we even think about. It's not even something that crosses our mind. Right? It was a different time, a different place. No one thinks about it because the world has changed. And our Sharia is flexible enough to change with the times in these areas. Right? That we don't have to follow those parts of our religion when the world changes, because that's something that's flexible. That's not the area where it's a concrete law. Allah did not say it's wajib to own slaves. He simply left it open to whatever is the common practice. Right? So, it's a clear example where when the urf changed, almost the whole ummah changed with it. So this is it. This is urf. This is it in a nutshell. This is why it's so important. This is a primary principle in the Hanafi madhab. Meaning, if we had to do our Hanafi fiqh properly, a lot of the fatawa we are following in this country will change. And Imam Abu Hanifa and his students, they found it to be highly crucial and important that fiqh is applicable to each community based on their culture. Right? And they had a very flexible approach to fiqh. Somewhere down the line, that got lost. We have to revive it. We have to revive that part of the Hanafi Madhab. And why I keep mentioning the Hanafi Madhab is because by and large, Durban is a Hanafi community. Right? It would be foolish for us to tell people not to be Hanafi, or to tell them to change to a different madhab, or to give up madhab altogether. Hanafi madhab gives us, it makes life easy, and it has the tools to reform our fiqh anyway, so why leave it? Right? The tools are available within the madhab, meaning you can swap to these other opinions and still be Hanafi. So, you know, why try and, again, that will be changing the urf. The urf of Durban is Hanafi, so why bring something else here instead? Right? So, we stick to the Hanafi madhab on these issues. And within the madhab, we can change it. Now, there is one more principle for change. And that's very important. That's next week's discussion. Next week, we're going to talk about istihsan. Istihsan simply means that when the qiyas of a scholar is causing harm or difficulty to society, you can go to a different opinion. You don't have to follow that opinion. Let's see what istihsan means. This is the principle of Imam Abu Hanifa. And we look at examples of how Imam Abu Hanifa did this, and even how Umar radiallahu anhu did this, right, next week. So next week's discussion, even putting in a more broader framework of all the madhabs, all of the madhabs agree that sometimes qiyas can be overridden on the basis of the goals of the Sharia, the maqasid of Sharia. That when you weigh the benefits and harms, if the harms outweigh the benefits, then the law can change to making more beneficial for people. Now we'll talk about that in details next week. One more point on urf. I mentioned the maxim al-ada muhakkama. Local culture is the deciding factor. There are actually about 10 subsidiary maxims, 10 maxims that govern that maxim. Right? Now next year when we discuss maxims of fiqh, we'll do an entire lecture on that. Right? So again, it's not something that's a free for all and anybody says what they want, and anybody comes up with whatever fatwa they want. There is a system for doing it. This is the introduction. Inshallah, next year we'll go into more details. With that, we come to our conclusion and open the floor to Q&A. So, any questions? Yes, sir.
Mahar. What do you read for
this? The Mahar?
Yeah, I mean, shouldn't it be different for different groups?
It should.
But we have to stand, I think, under them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Really, the Mahar, if you look at early Hanafi fiqh, was based on urf. That was the early Hanafi position, that you look at a woman's social status and what the woman of her social class expect, and that becomes the mahar. So the point here is that obviously a woman from, and people don't like to use these terms, but when you're doing fiqh, you have to be frank, a woman from an upper middle class family is going to expect different mahar from a woman from a family that's not so economically doing well. And so we should have different urfs and different levels of mahar based on these different levels of society. We shouldn't just be standard that one guy is marrying a millionaire's daughter and giving 100 rand mahar, you know, because that's what's the minimum or whatever it is. It doesn't make sense. Right? It needs to be based on the urf. Yes?
I'm just wondering, how binding is it when a fatwa comes out in law? Because I'm thinking of breaking out of oppressive cultures. For example, a woman driving in Saudi last year, we have gone against all the fatwas. But if you were one of those women who got in a car and drove, would you then be going against your religion and not just your law? And in order to change the culture sometimes away from an oppressive culture, I'm thinking of the culture of women in South Africa maybe 50 years ago, where we were bound to the kitchen and the homes, and now it's different for the pants example that you brought up.
Yeah.
If you were one of the first women wearing pants, now you wear pants without thinking. Mm-hmm. If you were one of the first women wearing pants, were you going against? So I'm wondering, I'm just afraid.
Is that first generation sinful or not, basically?
No, I'm afraid of both becoming binding in within an oppressive culture.
Okay.
From a woman's
next week we're talking about istihsan. And istihsan basically means that when a fatwa is harmful to society, then we do move to a different fatwa. So for example, if it is the urf of a society that a man beats his wife up, we don't make a fatwa based on that because that's harmful to society. Right? So ulama have to weigh, in maqasid al-sharia we call it the masali and the mafasid, the benefits and the harms. And all fiqh is weighed on this scale. So when something's benefits outweigh its harms, it's halal. When its harms outweigh its benefits, it's haram. So urf is not the only thing in play. You're not going to only look at urf. You're going to look at benefit and harm as well. And that's why I said next week when we discuss istihsan, we will talk about istihsan bil urf. Right? Because in the Hanafi madhab, there is this principle that when something causes difficulty or harm or it's a matter of necessity, then we move to a new fatwa. Right? So that will be more appropriate for next week's discussion, inshallah.
What you just said now, let's say there's another 9/11. Woman wearing a scarf on the subway or in buses are now really being attacked in a big way. Would there be a basis then for what you just said?
Good question. I'll give you a practical example of that.
You would say that women don't wear a scarf just because it's now like that.
Okay, so good point. So basically. I'm going to bring that up. So basically the question is like, if something like 9/11 had to happen again and a woman's life's in danger for wearing a scarf, or it might be abused or beaten, you know, again, ulama have discussed this. Let me give you a practical example. A few years ago when the coup took place in Egypt, right, and men with big beards were being rounded up. So one of my students from Egypt, he emailed me. And he told me, listen, I have a big beard. I have grown it my whole life. If I haven't left my house in 10 days, if I leave my house, they're going to lock me up. Is it permissible for me to shave my beard? I told him, yes. He said, yes, because this is now a matter of benefits and harms. So you have to understand, our Sharia, we have the... Firstly, things are on different levels. When we say something is haram, there's different levels of halal and haram. It's not all the same level. So let me give you an example of a woman... uncovering parts of her body. Most people are unaware of this. But for example, if you open Tafsir Al-Qurtubi to the verse on hijab, Imam Al-Qurtubi says, and he quotes Ibn Arabi as saying this as well, that a woman's hair, arms, and her legs below her knees are her minor awra. And from her chest to her knees are her major awra. So uncovering the hair or the arms is a lesser sin than uncovering from the chest to the knees. Now we treat all of it as the same. Right? Like nowadays, sometimes the sisters have a scarf, they mention, you might as well be naked, you're showing everyone your aura. Right? It's not the same. The early books of fiqh clearly stated that these are two different things. One's minor, one's major. So, can a woman expose her minor aura for the sake of safety and protection? Most of the time, yes. Yes, safety and protection overrides even bigger issues than that. I mean, the matter of eating pork to save your life, you know, or saying words of shirk to save your life. So again, we'll take it on a case-by-case basis, right? And if a woman genuinely fears for her life or for something like that, we would say for her to uncover her hair is a minor sin, and it is a minor sin. It's not a major sin. I don't know, people don't abuse that, but that's the truth. People always tell me, don't say that, but that's the truth. It's a minor sin, right? In all the madhabs. But for someone's life to be in danger, that overrides all of this. So in those cases, again, case by case basis, I would, again, someone's life, or even if there is a chance of them getting punched in the face or something, I would say temporarily it would be permissible until things come right. But as soon as things come right, then go back to the norm. And this applies to other situations as well. So for example, one of my students from Durban had a nice beard, but then he became a firefighter. He joined the firemen. And firemen are not allowed to grow beards because it's a fire hazard. Right? So he asked me, he's like, I want to be a firefighter, but my beard. I told him, it's fine. In your case, it's fine because we need firefighters. We don't want you your beard catching on fire when you're trying to save someone's life. So it's a different situation. Right? So again, fatwas change from person to person situations. It's also important that ulama understand the levels of haram. Not everything's on the same level. Right? People don't know this. People don't understand this. Hear the word haram, they think of it all as being one block and everything being the same. There's different levels, and those different levels can become halal based on different levels of necessity and difficulty. That's part of istihsan. That's next week's topic. Next week's topic, I'll talk about difficulty, necessity, and harm, and how those three are different. There's actually three different categories in fiqh. And all three of those make certain things halal. Right? So we'll talk about that next week, inshallah. Any more questions?
One of the best explanations I've heard about the shop wall, the Hadithi portion of the shop wall, was the Sheikh Umar Abdullah. He was a guest of the Islamic Forum here.
Okay.
In the south of. And he
he drew a difference between the sub-Bama and the Sava.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Whereas the sub-Bob means servile following with a feeling of inferiority.
Okay.
And that's not allowed. When
mm-hmm.
you follow just benignly another culture or another custom,
mm-hmm.
and that's what the Sava, which is not mentioned in this hadith,
mm-hmm.
is acceptable.
Okay, it's also another explanation, and either way, you're going to come to the same conclusions. Right? The same conclusion I came to with this explanation, that's a different way of looking. It makes sense as well. Allah knows best. So basically, he said there's two different words. One word is where you're resembling a person because you feel inferior to them, and that wouldn't be allowed. And that makes sense. But if you're resembling them just because you happen to live in the same culture and happen to do the same things, then that wouldn't be a sin. Again, that does make sense, but a different way of interpreting it. The thing is, the interpretation I took is found in many of the books of fiqh. So either way, it's fine.
Second question is about local culture as far as the indigenous population is concerned.
Yes.
For example, the operation of Labona.
Mm-hmm.
How do you marry push with a custom like that?
So this is what we need to do, right? You're asking about the indigenous population and their culture. This is what we need to do. We need ulama from that culture. We need people from those communities to become ulama, to study the usul al-fiqh, and for them to form the fatwa. Not for me.
Most of them are going to the Darul Uloom and
yes, I know. So, I'll give you an example. One of my friends, we studied together in the Darul Uloom. He's from that culture. He's part of the community. He's trying to change the fiqh. Obviously, on his own, he can't do it. He's slowly building up more people to get together to try and build what he calls it, indigenous South African fiqh. Right? So there are a group of them who studied there and realized this is not making sense, and they are getting together, they are having meetings, they are discussing it, they are trying to change. But again, we must also remember, right, to be very blunt, in this community, our people in terms of race, racially, are oppressing the other people in terms of religion, in that we're not giving them the right positions, we're not putting them on our Jamiat boards, we're not taking the Islamic scholarship seriously. To be frank, our people don't take it seriously unless it's the Indian guy sitting up here, right, or an Arab or a white person, right? Again, we have a racism in our community that needs to be addressed. So I would say, because South Africa is a multicultural society, every segment of this culture needs its own ulama who understand their own ulf and who will make the fatwa for the people of their community based on their ulf. Right? It can't be done by one person or one committee, because I don't understand every culture. There are so many cultures in South Africa, I don't understand all of them myself. Every day I'm learning something. You meet someone and it's like, you know, this is my culture. I'm like, whoa, I never even knew anyone did that. Right? Because this is a multicultural society. I mean, how many different languages do we have here alone? Right? Now, in each language to decide what's a halal words and haram words, what's appropriate manners and inappropriate manners. Ulama have to come from those cultures. So we have to do that. We have to train ulama, and inshallah, it's going to be a struggle. The biggest struggle is not training the ulama, it's getting our society to take them seriously and give them actual positions of scholarship in the community.
Umar Abdullah was here 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and he made a presentation on Islam and the cultural imperative.
Okay.
He used the word imperative. Okay. And he went through a whole series of slides
mm-hmm.
where he showed, for example, the masajids in different countries had different architecture.
Yes.
For example, you go to China, the mosque looks like the Chinese
temple or whatever
it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
You go to Russia, it looks like those Tsars kind of
mm-hmm.
architecture. And similarly, Morocco is different and so on. So he was doing exactly what you're doing.
Yeah.
Not from a fiqh perspective, but from a practical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And saying that we need to adopt and assimilate within the local cultures, provided out country.
Mm-hmm.
My issue here is the fact that there's a thing in human behavior where we say there's barriers to entry.
Yeah.
Right? So what my view is, right, that as Muslims in anybody culture, what's the best culture in terms of dress in particular?
Mm-hmm.
Because when I see somebody dressed in a particular way, either I can connect with him or I draw a veil, literally
yeah.
a veil.
Mm-hmm.
So people who are wearing kurtas, topis, and beards in a South African environment are actually barriers to entry for love.
That's true.
This is my interpretation.
Okay.
Hence, we shouldn't be wearing black, we shouldn't be wearing the white kurtas and topis, because that's not our culture. And I look at how Islam spread worldwide. Most of it in Indonesia as business people. They have an army. But if people adopted the Islam without adopting the dress. And so on, you can find many, many other examples.
Mm.
The point is that if you look at the South African situation, hardly any Hindus have become Muslim. Hardly any Afrikaners have become Muslims. Hardly any whites have become Muslims. It's very minority.
Mm.
Perhaps the way we are importing our culture, even our Muslims.
Yes.
I mean, Yusuf is there. He's been trying to do this for a long time. To create a South African mosque culture or architecture. To adapt to the local environment. So I think we've got serious challenges.
We do.
In terms of the way we profess our Islam, especially our dress codes. Our food, they love our biryani. That's one way of getting the dawah. So some things are acceptable.
Yeah.
Others are not.
So this is going to be a difficult thing, and this is why I say it's a life goal. It's not something you expect to change overnight. It literally takes an entire generation to change a culture. And in order to adapt to the local culture, we have to change a culture, meaning you have to change the mindset of our people, those who don't want to adapt. And that is very difficult because, you know, how do I put it? Whenever somebody wants to do this work, everybody says, don't be controversial. Right? But if nobody is controversial, nothing changes, right? So we have to do something. We have to start our own Darul Ulooms, maybe. Start our own Alim course, right? We have to train new generations of ulama. We have to write books on these topics, have public discussion of this topic, invite people from different opinions to sit and discuss, you know? If someone is saying you have to wear kurta and topi in South Africa, let's have a public debate about it. Get people on both sides and let... discuss it in a friendly way, again with full respect to the other side. Because again, in doing this, we cannot become disrespectful, because then we put a barrier between us and them, that they're not going to hear what we say. Right? He's right, it is a barrier to dawah in this country. If you look at the fact that Muslims have been in South Africa for 300 years, and we are still a tiny percentage compared to how many people are converting in the USA or UK and other countries where Muslims have been much less. They've only been there for like, what, one or two generations. Yeah, they've been here, like, literally they moved during most of your lifetime, the Muslims only started moving there, right? Before my time, but most of you guys. You know, why is Islam spreading there? Why are you seeing so many converts in those communities? I mean, why are there so many, I can't remember what's the socially acceptable word now. Latinos, no more socially acceptable, right? Basically, so many people from the Spanish-speaking American community converting to Islam. Why do we see that in America? Yeah, but here in South Africa, we don't see that. And not only that, but people are disconnected from us. Like, they see us and they walk in a different direction. There's something seriously went wrong, and solving it is not easy. It's not going to come overnight. It's going to come from hard work, discussion, heated debates, people getting angry, people calling each other names. Not us, we're going to be the ones who do things the right way. But that's just how society changes. But at the end of the day, somebody has to make the effort. So we'll take lots of time. We'll take two more questions, I think.
How do you understand practices that were practiced in the process of
Islam?
For example, akikah or the way the nikah is.
Yes.
And now it's become almost intrinsically part of the text. How do you understand that?
Okay, so again, that goes back to Sunnah. If the Prophet mentioned something and he mentioned a reward for it, or he mentioned a punishment for not doing it, or he gave some kind of a religious significance to it, then it becomes Sunnah. So for example, in the Prophet's time, in one of the hadiths, the Prophet mentioned specific that akikah, for example, that if you do it, it wards off calamity, right, for the child. So this is now a religious significance. So now it's Sunnah, now it's part of the religion. On the other hand, when the Prophet and the Sahaba had weddings, they had the small girls playing with the drums and singing. That's not Sunnah, that was their culture. Our culture will be different. Right, so what you're going to look at is, did the Prophet say this is part of our religion? Did he attach a reward to it? Did he attach a punishment to it? Did he attach some religious significance to it? When he did, we say it's part of our religion. When he did not, then we say it's not part of the religion. So for example, the Prophet said, my Lord has commanded me to commanded us to let the beards grow. So because he said, my Lord has commanded me, so we say, okay, this is part of the religion. But when it comes to how he dressed, he never said, my Lord has commanded me to dress like an Arab. No, as I always say, if the Prophet came in Mexico, South Africans would be having a really hard time following Sunnah dressing. Right? But again, it was never meant to be. The Prophet never said this. The Sahaba never said this. The Quran never said this. So we see that was his culture. So the important point is, what did he say about it? Another point also related to that, eating. Right? The Prophet ﷺ said, don't eat with your left hand because shaitan eats with your left hand. So therefore, eating with the right hand becomes sunnah. Right? So why don't we say sitting on the floor and eating is sunnah? Because he never said anything about it. He just did it because that's what the Arabs did. Right? So it all comes down to, did he say something about it or not? Once he said something about it, then it falls into the category of the sunnah.
The fact that culture and norms are constantly changing, what then and why and what would be the determining factor for that norms based on what to become wajib? Would it not go against the claim to make that law based on what wajib?
Okay.
Because then your laws are, your culture is going to constantly change.
So fiqh does change every few years. That's the nature of fiqh. It's supposed to change.
So then if you're making it wajib, then I'm not.
No, it's wajib for that. Again, fatwa is based on the current culture. So something will be wajib while that's the culture. When the culture changes, the wajib changes.
What would be the determining factor?
Determining factor, what's the dominant culture currently? Again, we go back to our list of the conditions. Right? Look at the list. What at the moment, when what is popular, consistent, and current? Those three things you have to look at. So that means, really in fiqh, you're supposed to review and change fiqh every 5 or 10 years. You don't just make a fatwa and people follow it for the next 100 years. You are supposed to review it every few years because culture does change. Now, why do you make it wajib? Because, firstly, look at the right to the husband and the wife. Allah commands us, وَعَاشِرُهُنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ. This is a command. Treat her well according to the oath. Right? Now, if you do, that means it's a command, that means it's wajib. Right? Now, if you don't make it wajib, a man will say, the hadith only says I must give her food, clothing, and shelter. I don't have to spend time with her. I don't have to treat her nicely. I don't have to, you know, go out with her for dinners. You say, no, this is your culture. Yeah, it's just, again, not everything in the culture becomes wajib. Some become mustahab. Some become halal. I'm saying certain things become wajib, like the rights. Or in business dealings. If you don't make certain things wajib when it comes to business dealings, anybody abuses anybody in business. Anyone can just say, no, I'm not doing that. And that causes friction. That causes a lot of friction. Because, for example, if you live in a culture where a handshake means something, and somebody shakes your hand and says, no, it doesn't mean anything to me. No, you can now use culture to say, no, it's wajib on you to agree to what you said before shaking hands. Otherwise, people will abuse the law. And it becomes a free-for-all. Right? So, it is important that we make certain things wajib based on culture. Not everything. Generally, culture is used for making things mustahab or makruh or halal. But in certain aspects like the rights of the husband and wife and business law, it can make things wajib. Right? But it has to be popular, consistent and current. And when that changes, the fiqh changes accordingly. Is that clear? When that changes, the fiqh changes accordingly. So fiqh has to be reviewed all the time.
There's a danger of making things wajib, you know, like, then it becomes like,
it does. It has to. It has to. Because remember, if you the way society works is if you don't make certain things, it comes
with misinterpretation of the cultural norm as well.
No, but certain parts of culture are considered wajib. So, for example, how do I put this? If someone in our community gets married and the man just literally gives her, you know, almost nothing, but just what's wajib based on hadith, will she ever be happy? How do you force him now to give her things that make her happy? You have to make it wajib. If you don't say it's wajib, he's never going to take you seriously. Right? So that can be abused. If you don't make these things wajib, it can be abused. Same with business law. So wajib, again, in Hanafi madhab, we have this the difference between wajib and farz. Wajib isn't on the same level as farz. Wajib is like a lower level of compulsory. It's something that changes over time. But the point is, why we make things wajib is so that people don't abuse the law. And again, that's, you said that would be like enforcing the culture. Some aspects of culture need to be enforced, particularly when people's rights are involved. And that's the only time you're going to find wajib, when it comes down to people's rights. Otherwise, people are never going to fulfill each other's rights because they're going to say it's not in the Quran and Hadith. And so when it comes to human rights and harm and hurting people, we say, you know, we have to make certain things wajib in order to protect people's rights and in order to protect people from harm. I think when we study next week's topic, inshallah, it will become more clear. It's already 9 o'clock. Any more questions? I can take one short question only.
The concept of bid'ah.
Yes.
How
So bid'ah is another whole different topic for discussion. Basically, there's two schools of thought there. They're always clashing on it. One school of thought is it falls under everything's halal until proven to be haram. That's the Shafi Madhab takes that approach. The other approach, like the Hanbali Madhab, is all acts of worship are bid'ah until proven to be sunnah. So that's why there's always a clash. Right? So let me give you an example of that. Reciting Quran for Isali Sawab. Right? In the Hanafi Madhab, it's permissible. In the Hanbali Madhab, it's considered a bid'ah. Because they have this difference of opinion on what's considered a bid'ah. So it's actually considered permissible in one madhab and a bid'ah in another madhab. So even on the issue of bid'ah, we have to learn tolerance to differences of opinion. We can't just enforce it on people and say that, this is a bid'ah and that's a bid'ah. And again, I think we need to do a whole lesson on bid'ah. Because it's a very, very deep topic. There's many differences of opinion. There's some ulama who divided bid'ah into 5 different categories. And, it's something we have to go into separately. I would say that as long as the local culture is not an act of worship, it has nothing to do with bid'ah. As long as it's not an act of worship. That's why when people tell me celebrating birthday is bid'ah, why? I mean, I can understand you saying it's haram. I can understand the fifth qiyas that leads to saying it's haram. I understand that. But what's the qiyas that leads to bid'ah? Because it's not an act of worship. Bid'ah is what? A new act of worship or a new belief. That's what bid'ah is. You're adding an act of worship or adding a belief to Islam. Now, what exactly qualifies as that? That literally needs a whole hour of discussion separately. But here, we're talking not about acts of worship and belief. That's why we said not ibadat mu'amalat. We're talking about social dealings. So most of the time, bid'ah won't come into the picture when it comes to social dealings.
Okay, JazakAllah khair for that. This is the first session. Inshallah, next week will be our last session.